Welcome back to the program. Woody Allen once said that the world was divided into two groups, the horrible and the miserable. The horrible, he said, were people with painful or terminal diseases or deformities, and the miserable, well, that was everyone else. The good news is, this isn't so. However, happiness is still a very serious business. We pursue it with fervor, yet it doesn't seem to last. We're taught as kids that the pursuit of happiness is a kind of fundamental right. So we pursue it, but seldom do we understand its myths, delusions, and even its true joys. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Sonia Lubomirsky. She's a professor of psychology at UC Riverside. Her research on the possibility of permanently increasing happiness has been honored worldwide, and her 2008 book, The How of Happiness, has been translated into 19 languages. It is my pleasure to welcome Sonia Lubomirsky here to talk about her newest work, The Myth of Happiness. What should make you happy but doesn't? What should make you happy but does? Sonia Lubomirsky, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Great to have you here. Is at core, from an evolutionary biological perspective, is happiness just about a kind of drive reduction? We're hungry, we need to eat, we need love, we need to find a mate. I mean, is it really about fulfilling those basic human drives and how we go about doing that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I do. I mean, there are definitely evolutionary kind of reasons for happiness, you know, because, you know, research shows that happier people are, in a sense, more successful in life. You know, if you're happier, you're going to be more creative, you're going to have better relationship, you're going to attract sort of social support, you're going to be more productive at your work, you're going to be healthier. So happier people have stronger immune systems. And so I do think there are evolutionary kind of roots of happiness. But now we all, of course, need the unhappy, kind of anxious, vigilant person as well to sort of alert us to threats. But I think happiness is important. It's not just about feeling good.
As we go up and down in our own happiness, is it like weight? Do we return to individual set points that are part of our personality and temperament that we're in fact born with?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I do make that analogy to weight quite a bit. So in my first book, The How of Happiness, I talk quite a bit about sort of this idea that there's a set point, what's called a set point for happiness. And so this is kind of a baseline to which we tend to return to after a negative or positive life changes. And happiness has a genetic component. So some of us are, you know, kind of born happier than others. I mean, if you look around you, well, you'll notice some people are sort of naturally happier than others. A little bit like some people are born with a kind of a thinner or a fatter disposition. But that doesn't mean that we're doomed to experience that, you know, that level of the set point. It just means that if we're, you know, a little bit of unlucky, if we're born with, you know, kind of a less happy than others, it just means we have to put more effort into being a happier person if that's what we want to be.
And, of course, underlying all this is this notion you talk about that, in fact, we are very unsatisfied most of the time, or our satisfaction is very short-lived in those moments when we are particularly happy.
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, one of the myths of happiness that I talk about in the book, The Myths of Happiness, is sort of this idea that, you know, oh, I'll be happy. I'm not happy now, but I'll be happy when, you know, Mr. Right comes along, or when I get that promotion I wanted, or when I'm rich. But the truth is, I mean, those things do make us happy, but they don't make us happy for as long as we think they will. And so we have to kind of understand that, be prepared for that. And so when the time comes when we feel like, you know, our marriage or our job or sort of our life is sort of not what it used to be, it's sort of not as exciting as it used to be, that we have to understand that that's just a perfectly normal human process, you know, because if we don't know that, we might make some bad decisions. We might jettison perfectly good partners or jobs because we think, you know, there's someone else, something even better for us.
Where does that come from? Where does this hedonic adaptation that you talk about, this lack of satisfaction, where does that come from?
Right. Well, you know, I think hedonic adaptation doesn't have to be about lack of satisfaction, but basically adaptation is the phenomena that we get used to changes in our lives, you know, quite quickly. And you know, there are evolutionary explanations for it, that it's functional for us to kind of get used to changes so then we can be kind of alert or vigilant to sort of new things. So, for example, you know, if we're like, you know, let's say we meet a new person and we're really excited about them, is that if we continue to be so excited or passionate, we won't notice, you know, threats in the environment. We won't notice sort of new opportunities for reward. And so it is evolutionarily adaptive to to get used to things, and it's quite a good thing to be able to adapt to negative changes, right? Because otherwise we'll be kind of forever unhappy when bad things happen to us. But there is this downside, and the downside is that when we get married or when we make more money, when we buy a new car, you know, eventually we get used to those things.
And in fact, part of it is defining for ourselves the things that really matter, the things that are really significant to us over the long run.
Yeah, that's right. So what I talk a little bit about that in The Myths of Happiness, that, you know, what really matters, you know, one thing that really matters is relationships. You know, lots and lots of research shows that relationships are just critical to happiness. When we study the happiest people, one thing they have in common is they have fulfilling relationships, they have social support, they have, you know, deep friendships. It's important to focus, you know, on our relationships.
Where do children begin to get their understanding of happiness?
Wow. You know, at what point do they? That's a great question. I'm not sure if I know the answer to that. I mean, there are studies of happiness with children, and we can measure happiness in children. Now, I have not worked with any kids who are younger than like 10. So, I don't really know. But I think, our society, especially, you know, Western society, is so focused on happiness. It just seems that, you know, I mean, they certainly learn the emotion, you know, very, very early on, you know, kind of in preschool age. I mean, they know what it means to be happy and sad. I'm not a developmental psychologist, right. I'm not an expert on this.
Do we process negative and positive emotions in the same way? Is there something in the way we process those things that is fundamentally different, or are they really part of the same rubric?
You know, I think that there are some things that are fundamentally different. You know, one really strong finding is that negative emotions are kind of, how do I say this, are kind of like twice as bad as positive emotions are good. So basically, the bad is stronger than the good. So having, you know, 5 minutes of a negative emotion is worse than having 5 minutes of a positive emotions is good. So they have kind of a stronger punch, stronger impact. Again, I think there are evolutionary reasons for that when we're angry, when we're anxious, when we're sad, it's usually a signal that something is wrong that we need to pay attention to in our life. So it's important that we pay attention to that signal. But I think that's something that it's important to keep in mind. And so when we think about our day-to-day happiness, you know, what can we do to reduce negative emotions? Not eliminate them, because I think they are sometimes very important to have, because again, they are signals, but to reduce them.
Talking about that day-to-day happiness, one of the things that you talk about that becomes clear is that those people that focus on the here and now, that focus on each day, that they are much more happy over the long run.
Yeah, that's right. I think because, you know, when you think about, I mean, let's ask ourselves this question, kind of, what made you happy yesterday? Was it knowing how much money you have in the bank? Was it your house? Was it your job? Well, I mean, actually, I should say the job often does make you happy or unhappy, but it's often sort of those little things that happen throughout the day. Maybe there was a deadline that you failed to meet at work. Maybe your child had a temper tantrum, or your car broke down, or you got stuck in traffic. I mean, it's those kind of daily events that really have a huge impact on our happiness. And understanding that is important, because then we can try to kind of organize our lives in a way that that minimizes like the daily hassles and maximizes the daily uplifts.
Do we need, in order to be happy in a broader sense, do we need a greater sense of personal meaning? Do we need to find ways in which we connect our happiness to a broader set of life goals that have more significant meaning?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I have a whole section in The Myths of Happiness about meaning and purpose. I think it's very important. Lots of research shows that happiness is associated with sort of having kind of a sense of meaning. And I talk about this, for example, in a chapter about on aging. You know, when we get older, you know, older people are actually happier than younger people. But one way that we can kind of cope with some of the, you know, big changes that happen as we age, or at any age really, is to sort of, as you say, kind of connect our life to something bigger than ourselves. And it could be You know, it could be our children. I mean, it could be some kind of project, something that we do at work. Like we all want to feel that, like, when we leave this world, you know, we leave it sort of a better place, that we leave a legacy. And this could, by the way, we could think about this in our 20s as much as in our 60s or beyond. And so all of us care about meaning, and we get meaning in different ways. Some people get it from religion and spirituality, and other people get it from, you know, artistic pursuits. You know, there's just many, many different ways we can get meaning and purpose.
In many ways, it's what sets human beings apart, that across species there is the pursuit of happiness in its own way, but this sense of connecting it to a broader purpose, a broader meaning, is in many ways one of the things that makes us uniquely human.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that too. I mean, of course, it's hard to know kind of what animals are thinking. You know, we can measure happiness in animals. In fact, I was just reading a study that was measuring happiness in apes. So we kind of know, and I'm sure people who have pets will say, oh, they're happy or they're not happy. But yeah, meaning, I think that's a uniquely human. And it's so, you know, it's very powerful, right? Because it's something that really, that we can kind of, return to, something that we can find satisfaction in, you know, kind of over the long term.
To what extent is expectations, and this is sort of the other side of the meaning issue, there are expectations of us in life. Arguably, that makes us happier in some ways when we fulfill those expectations.
Right, or it makes us unhappy when we don't fulfill them. So actually, a big theme of the myths of happiness is kind of about expectations. And actually, what I worry about is having unrealistic or kind of outsized expectations, you know, because one of the myths of happiness is the idea that, you know, oh, we'll be, you know, marriage and jobs and money, those are going to make us so happy. You know, we have really unrealistic expectations. We don't realize that, you know, after we get that new job, you know, there's going to be stress, there's going to be challenge, and most of them our time is going to be, we're going to think about other things, maybe not the fact that we got a new job, but maybe the fact that we need to, you know, fix our car, you know, or pick up our kid from school. And so I think actually having unrealistic expectations and escalating expectations can be harmful.
In terms of escalating expectations, and certainly our particular culture is one that reinforces that expectation, have you found these ideas, some of the things we've been talking about here today, pretty much cross-cultural, however?
Yeah, you know, I do some cross-cultural research, and so do others. I have yet to find any kind of major differences across cultures. You know, certainly, I mean, the pursuit of happiness is important in pretty much any culture that researchers have looked at. And in terms of expectations, I haven't looked at that specifically, but I think that's sort of universal. I mean, human beings, kind of, we always want more, you know, and that's one way that we make progress, is that we're never quite satisfied with, you know, what we have. And that's a good thing. I mean, the downside is that it means that, you know, we don't stay happy for too long. And I'm convinced that that's a fairly universal process.
And there's also this desire for the new and different that is part of that. And sometimes it leads to progress and sometimes it doesn't. But nonetheless, we seem to have this insatiable desire for new and different.
That's right. So whatever's kind of familiar, you know, we take for granted, right? We get used to. And again, you know, there's evolutionary reasons for this, that we're more likely to kind of notice, right, take note of novel things in our environment. So we have this desire for novelty and variety and surprise, at least in when it comes to sort of positive things in life. But, you know, what we can learn from that finding is that we can try to bring in more novelty or challenge or kind of new opportunities into our life. I mean, it's not easy to do, but we can do that. We can try to, you know, when it comes to our jobs, for example, you know, we can ask ourselves, what can we do? Maybe we can learn something new, a new way of being productive or efficient. Maybe we can challenge ourselves a new way, meet new people. You know, all of those things can bring in kind of new opportunities and novelty and surprise.
Is there a relationship that research shows between productivity and happiness? I mean, I guess the other side of that is the tortured artist up in the garret somewhere. Mm-hmm. But is there this relationship that we see between happiness and productivity?
Well, we know that happier people are more productive, so that kind of goes both ways. Happier people have been found to be more productive at work and to get higher ratings from their supervisors, to be more creative. I have no doubt that sort of feeling productive, being productive makes you happy, certainly gives you positive emotions. But everything in moderation, right? So I think maybe your example is kind of an extreme. So we want to work hard and be productive, and that makes us happy. But if we're workaholics, that's going to have negative side effects. And if we don't work hard enough, that's going to have negative side effects. So I really believe in sort of Aristotle's, golden mean.
What role have you found that faith plays in happiness?
In my book, The How of Happiness, I have a chapter on faith. And what researchers find is that, people who have faith, people who are religious or people who are spiritual are happier than people who are not. Now what do we take from that? I mean, there's really two reasons that scientists think that they see this relationship. One is that people who have faith tend to have stronger relationships. So they have sort of more social support, stronger family relationships, because they have kind of communities on which they can rely on, often religious communities. And people who have faith also have been found to say, or at least report, that they have more kind of purpose or meaning in life, and that kind of purpose and meaning helps them cope with negative things, right, with tragedies. But my conclusion from that is that, you can have those things even when you're not religious, right? You can have a strong community and purpose in life, from other ways, not just religious communities. So I think that's an important lesson, but as I said, the bottom line is that the people who have faith are a little bit happier.
You touched on something before about the relationship between happiness and physical health. That's also something that seems to work both ways.
That's right. So happier people are physically healthier. They have less pain. They're less likely to get, heart disease or cancer. They're more likely to live longer. Those are all correlational studies. So, we're not sure exactly kind of what the causal factors are. And of course the direction goes the other way too. If you're healthier, you're going to be happier. And in fact, I was just learning about some new research yesterday that shows that people who have especially kind of health problems that interfere with daily, functioning. So like if you have trouble breathing, if you have chronic pain, that really makes people unhappy, for obvious reasons.
I know that you were involved in some survey, I think middle school kids that were learning about happiness and learning about life. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, actually, this is such a great study. It just came out in the journal PLOS ONE, which is free and widely available to anyone. So what we did is a study with kids in 4th, 5th, and 6th grades. So these were 9 to 11-year-olds, and they were in the Vancouver schools. So we were working in the Vancouver, Canada school district. And we asked these kids to do acts of kindness every week, I believe for 4 weeks. And what we found is that kids who did acts of kindness got happier over time, but not only did they get happier, they became more popular with their peers. So their classmates kind of liked them more after they did acts of kindness, even though a lot of the acts of kindness were not even done in the classroom, they were done at home. So something kind of rubbed off on these kids that when they came to school, they were liked more by their peers.
And that relates back to this whole idea of meaning and purpose that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think helping others certainly gives us meaning and purpose. But just in general, there's lots of research on generosity and kindness, and I've done quite a bit of it, sort of showing that people who help others, they can change their whole. And I did a study in the work environment at a company where, when people started to be kind of more generous to each other, they kind of increased the morale, raised the morale of the whole, workplace. Studies show that if you spend your money on other people as opposed to yourself, you'll be happier. So just lots and lots of work that shows that kind of contributing to others, contributing to your community, helping others makes us happier.
In a broader sense, is it fair to say that sometimes it is the pursuit of happiness that gets in the way, that thwarts happiness?
Right. So that, I think, was a really good point. So there's some new research that shows that if we make the pursuit of happiness kind of too important a goal for us, like if we kind of really hold it in the forefront and we're thinking about it a lot, oh, I want to be happy, I want to be happy, and if we're constantly monitoring our happiness, you know, am I happy yet? Am I happy yet? That can really backfire, and that can stand in the way of becoming happier. And so the lesson really is that we want to pursue happiness by pursuing sort of other goals, you know. So try to, do whatever gives you meaning in life. Pursue meaningful goals. Be kind to others. Try to be more grateful. Introduce novelty into your life and sort of focus on those goals, and happiness will come sort of as a byproduct.
Sonia Lubomirsky, her book is The Myth of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. Sonia, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. You have some great questions.
Thank you.